I'm up on the tie wire.
I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Nancy Lechuga.
And welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire, when our guest today is Mary Shebis, author of Incarnadine, which is a book of poems that won the National Book Award. And on Poetic License is our own Nancy Lechuga. Nancy, what are you going to talk about in your Poetic License?
Well, my Poetic License is actually really cheesy, so I do need to give a disclaimer.
Oh, you know, in defense of cheesy, it's not easy being cheesy.
I wrote kind of like a love letter to humanity. Sometimes we're very hard on ourselves, and it was just kind of like a reassurance, kind of like a mom would do.
Oh, you know, nice. But to everybody, to all human
to
beings.
Everybody, yeah.
Awesome. Can't
just
wait to hear it.
Everybody is really awesome.
Oh,
yeah,
cool. So. You know, it's funny. I just saw that play, The Misanthrope, you know, by Molière. We don't use that word very often today, but misanthrope means one who hates humanity, who just finds it disgusting and intolerable. And it's about this man who thinks everybody's a hypocrite and he just hates everybody. You know, and after watching that play for 2 hours, it'll be nice to hear the opposite. So good. Thanks for sharing that with us. I just have to say that this poet, Mary Shebis, is just, I mean, she's just a fantastic poet. I don't know how old she is, but quite frankly, she looks very young. This is her second book. It's a beautiful book. I read it. I used some of the poems in my graduate seminar over the summer. She's just an amazing poet. But I have to thank you, Nancy, because you're the one that brought Mary Shebis to my attention. How did it happen? How did you encounter this poet?
Well, every once in a while, one of my favorite things to do is I like to hang out at Barnes & Noble. I'll go to the poetry section, of course, and I look for new books of poems, and mm-hmm. I just pulled out this really thin, it was hiding in between, you know, these thick volumes of Pablo Neruda and you know, Lorca, and just the classic books of poems
that they have there. Speaking of Pablo Neruda, remind me to tell you some really good news that I heard.
Oh, okay.
Anyway, you found this book.
I found this book, and the cover is really interesting. It's this very, very Catholic, very religious cover.
Of the Annunciation.
When the
angel appeared to Mary and says, you're going to be pregnant.
Yeah.
Basically, you're having God as a baby.
Yeah, so I looked at it, and I thought it was going to be
religious
very
poetry.
Religious. So usually I have a process for, you know, buying books of poetry and what I like. So what I do is I'll usually flip to the very last poem. And if that catches my attention.
You read the last poem first?
I read the last poem first, and then I flip through the book, and I land on mm-hmm. in the middle. And if I like that one, then that's pretty good indicative that most of the poems are going to be, or all of the poems are going to be good.
And is at that point that when you buy the book, or do you?
Well, at that point, I'm interested.
Ooh.
At that
point, you're not convinced yet.
No, I'm not convinced yet. And then I kind of do, you know, in the old cartoons where you just kind of flip through the book really fast mm-hmm. and you see the movement.
Right.
If I see movement, different style, different forms, then you've got more points.
Oh, and that's definitely the case in this book. There's so many different forms.
So I was really captivated by her imagery, and you could just read one line from a random line from each poem and you'll go away with something.
Nice. That's what I always tell my students. I said, you know, the line itself must have integrity. You know, the line, yeah, it connects to other lines, but the line itself is really important. You know, the way I usually choose a book is kind of opposite of you. I read the first poem first. And because I know as poets always want the first poem to be a good poem, you know, a great poem. I mean, you want to grab them with that first poem. So I figure if their best poem isn't going to grab my attention, then I'm probably not going to read on. But anyway, whatever reason you chose this book, Nancy, thank you, because it certainly has contributed to my love and respect of poetry. And I can't wait to find out what she's going to come up with next. Remember I said I had good news about Pablo Neruda? I was just reading in El Mundo, I just got back from Madrid, that 20 new poems have been discovered by Pablo Neruda.
And, yeah, I saw that article.
Yeah, and it's going to be released in Spanish, in Latin America, and in Spain in a couple of weeks. So I look forward to getting those poems, and they quoted some of the poems, and it sounded like classic Neruda love poetry. But what I'm interested in is who is going to be able to translate them in English, because you know there's going to be a line of people mm-hmm. wanting to translate that, to be the official translator. I think I'm going to throw my hat in the ring, so to speak. But who the heck am I? I've never translated poetry, but really looking
sure
forward to that.
Are you sure you want to do that? I've heard your commentary about Neruda and...
What do you mean you heard my commentary? What does that mean?
I think you posted like a Facebook status one uh-huh. once about Neruda and his womanizing.
Oh, well, that's just a fact. Well, he was quite a womanizer, and
you didn't seem to agree though. You didn't seem to like him very much.
Oh no, I think he's one of the greatest poets. I think reading Neruda is like an avalanche. The language just falls and just collects things on its way down. No, what I was pointing out is that that's one of the things that we tend to overlook was mm-hmm. really quite how gender biased, sexist his poetry could be.
Yeah.
But we excuse him, you know, because of the language.
Yeah.
And we excuse him because of his commitment to politics and his commitment to his country and to his people.
Yeah.
But yeah, quite frankly, if you read like the captain's verses, it's all about how she worships me. And
that's I have a very conflicting relationship with Neruda. It's kind of like being in a bad relationship. You kind of really like the romance, but then there's...
Yeah, but then they say something stupid and you know, oh my God, that is so sexist. Why doesn't he at least wash one dish?
Exactly, that's how I feel.
I don't think Neruda would wash a dish, quite frankly.
I don't think so either.
All right, well, excellent. We look forward to talking to Mary Shebitz, author of Incarnadine, which won the National Book Award for Poetry, and that is one of the greatest prizes you can get in poetry. So we're very excited. Stick around.
Mary Shebitz is the author of a previous poetry collection, Granted, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. She teaches at Lewis and Clark College and lives in Portland, Oregon. Welcome, Mary, to Words on a Wire.
Mary, thank you for joining us on the show. I'd like to start out with just a general question about this fantastic book, which won the National Book Award, which is, you know, for those who are listening, no small thing. The judges said Incarnadine was a religious book for non-believers. How do you feel about that description?
Well, first, thank you so much for having me. And I love that description. I was so grateful for that description because it was very much the project I wanted to bring into the world. I wanted to use this religious iconography and carry it forward into secular meditation to try to make use of something that a secular world maybe had left behind and think, well, maybe it actually can still be useful even beyond the context of religion or belief.
One of the themes in the book is the Annunciation, when the angels appeared to Mary and, you know, basically told her what was going to happen. And a little funny fact, it didn't occur to me until last night, and I've been reading this book over and over for the last couple of weeks, but it didn't occur to me until last night that your name is Mary.
Yeah. Right.
But what is it about that theme, that the Annunciation, what is it about that fascinated you?
Well, I think I probably have a few answers to that. You know, one does have to do with the fact that my name is Mary, and I grew up in a Catholic world, and I attended the Church of the Annunciation, and this was an image I spent a lot of time simply looking at. So it snagged my imagination really early on. I always felt like I had my identity was in some way in relation to this figure of Mary. But what really sort of opened it up for me was a trip to Italy where I was looking at these paintings in the museum. And out of all of these religious scenes, I loved the sense of encounter in the Annunciation. I loved, I don't know, the kind of joy, in a sense, of the scene. that, you know, here was a human creature, a human girl, and here was an angel, a non-human creature, and they are actually in the same scene together, perceiving one another, communicating in some way. And even just that sense of possibility that there can be some interaction with something beyond us. I love that vision. But part of what I also found really moving looking at the paintings was the insistence by so many of the painters on the distance between these two figures, right? Often articulated with a lot of distance, a lot of objects between them, including columns. And that seemed to really honor the complication of what it might be to encounter someone truly not like you. It's not an easy communication. It's perhaps not a complete communication or understanding. There's always distance. And, you know, the paintings I saw more and more as the subject in these paintings is actually the distance between the two figures. And I love that. I love thinking about that very energized space between them. And all the other religious icons really have a figure in the center rather than a space. And that's what I started thinking about wanting to write into. What if my poems could occupy a similar space?
We're talking to Mary Shebas, author of Incarnadine, which won the National Book Award for Poetry. I wanted to ask you about the visual poem. You wrote an essay, I think it appeared on, was it poetry.org?
That was on Grey Wolf.
Grey Wolf, that's it. Wonderful press outside of Minneapolis, I believe. But you were talking about how the temporal nature of poetry, that, and I guess by that you mean that, you know, when we read a poem, it's just that we're in the moment, we're experiencing the poem, and that in many ways the visual poem, that is the poem that is striking immediately, even before reading it. In this case, you have a, you know, a picture of the sun, where the lines kind of extend out as little rays of the sun, that it kind of disrupts the temporal nature of poetry. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
I can try. I mean, I find this a really tricky and endlessly fascinating subject. And certainly there are people who have much more to offer on it than I do.
Well, let me rephrase the question then. When we look at a visual poem, like I'm reminded of that poem that's shaped like a swan, or a poem that's shaped like a, you know, anything. In fact, I had a graduate student turn in a poem shaped like a bird, and it seemed more gimmick than it did organic. And it's really difficult to get away with a poem that is shaped by something. Yet, you did it twice in this book at least, one with a little graph where you said was an outline based on a friend's teaching lessons, and then the other one with this poem, The Shape of the Sun. How do you get away from gimmick? How do you make that poem organic?
You know, I thought about this a lot because, you know, my own history is I used to just hate visual poems. I just, you know, if I was teaching in a textbook about poetry, the chapter I always skipped in teaching was a chapter on visual poems because I always found them gimmicky, and I was always afraid, oh no, I'm going to get poems about baseball in the shape of a baseball, and so it wasn't something that I thought a lot about for a long time. You know, when I said that the poems deal with the temporal, it's just hooking into that idea that poems work with time, I think, that they have a beginning and they move through and have an ending in a way that's very different from a painting, which we take in all at once.
Right. And like music, poetry can't be summarized. You can't really summarize a poem. You have to be there.
Correct. That's right. But at the same time, and, you know, this might for me have something to do with thinking about how religious icons are used for meditation, which are, you know, primarily a visual history. And part of what I was trying to do in this collection is think about using these old icons for a more secular meditation. So it's probably not an accident that I started thinking about how visual things prompt meditation. And there certainly is a history of, you know, visual arrangements of words as meditative objects, not just pictorial images. So the thing I loved about the one that looks a little bit like a sunburst is that I really loved the idea that it is something you can take in all at once on one level. And then as you wish, you can sort of zoom in and out of it. And that was one where I really did begin with the form.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't say, here's an idea and here would be the great form for it. I really started thinking about what would be a poem that actually would suit this form. You know, I honestly don't know if I avoided the gimmicky through it.
I think you did, and I'll tell you why I think you did.
Yeah.
You don't compromise the line. And I think in a lot of visual poetry, the line is compromised for the image. But here, the lines, they go out, you know, like rays of the sun, but each line is complete. You know, each line,
yeah.
It's not like it's just an eye, you know, because
right.
of how you, 'cause you have to have the thin neck of the swan, for example.
Right.
And the other interesting thing about this, I see it kind of like that painting by Velázquez, Las Meninas, where you're standing in front of the painting and you're looking at it and you're not quite sure what is amiss, but then suddenly it occurs to you that you are part of the painting, that the painting does not exist without you, and that everybody's looking at you, and you see your image in the mirror, and you're the king and the queen, and you're part of the painting. And this poem, you're part of the poem. You have to turn the page. You have to
right.
turn the book around and around to read the lines, and you probably look silly to people if you're reading it in a buzz, because what is that, a centerfold? But you become part of the poem. And it really does have that meditative effect, I think, because you are actually interacting with it.
Yeah, thank you. You know, that was my dearest hope, to try to provoke that interaction. But, yeah, for me, I felt like the form, you know, and I had readers who said, this is too gimmicky, don't include it in the book.
Uh-huh.
But for me, I ended up feeling like I did need it to be in that form, because every line is modifying that central subject, which is also posited as an absence
yeah.
by that form, and then every line can work as both a modifier and as a question about that missing or at least unseen central subject of God or not God.
Right. And quite frankly, you know, had you included it as the first poem, it may not have worked as successfully. But by the time we get to that, you certainly have earned our trust. We're talking to Mary Shebus, author of Incarnadine. It's a book of poems, won the National Book Award. And Mary, we have this segment called Poem of the Week, where we and if we have a poet on the show, we ask the poet if they'd be willing to read one of their poems.
Sure. Absolutely. I used to work night shifts at a group home for mentally disabled adults, and I loved the job, I loved the people, and, you know, the whole book is sort of centered around the idea of encounter, and especially the idea of encounter between creatures, people who have some sense of distance or difference between them. And have the possibility of perhaps changing one another. One of the things about the job is I was allowed to sleep during the night if everyone else was sleeping. And there was one woman who did not like to go to sleep, and so this is the poem that takes off from that. Night shifts at the group home for Lily Mae. The job was easy. I tucked them in, kicked off my shoes, listened for the floor to go quiet. Everyone slept except one. Outside her door, she paced, she hummed, holding the edge of her torn nightgown. Pointing, I told her, to bed, your bed. But she would not stay there. She was old, older than my mother. Manic, caught up in gibberish, determined to sleep on my cot. At first, it was just to quiet her. I could only sleep if she slept, and I needed relief from myself. That is how she became a body next to mine, whether or not I wanted there to be a body. She climbed into my bed. I let her sleep hot and damp against my spine. All night she rocked, she turned, she poked her spastic elbows into my calves and slurred her broken noises in the dark. All the old fans went round in clicks those summer nights, and she rolled in bed and kicked me in the head, and I was happy. No words, no tricks. I just didn't love my loneliness. My mind felt cooler with her there. Beside her, I could have been anyone. She had no word for me, and not the kind of mind to keep one. And if she kicked me some nights, just for the fun of it, who was I to disappoint my one? Sometimes I imagine I was someone she won at a fair as the wheel spun under the floating, unfaltering sun and clicked each lucky one and one until I was happily undone.
Wow. That was Mary Shebitz reading from her book Incarnadine. Thank you so much, Mary. I have to tell you, I'm teaching a graduate poetry workshop next semester, and I'm using this book.
Oh, thank you. And thank you for having me.
My name is Nancy Lechuga, poet, lover of words, of serenatas, and all things cliché. For my poetic license today, I am reading a love letter to humans. What inspired this piece were conversations that I've had with my friends and listening to their hardships and their triumphs and noticing how they don't give themselves enough credit for all that they do. And I was started to think about how we live with guilt about these feelings of inadequacy and how we're not good enough. So that's why I decided to write a love letter to humans. Dear humans, if your pain showed through your walk, you'd be bumping into walls, tripping over cracks, falling on weeds, and stumbling onto parked cars. But instead, you walk like that. You walk as if you aren't afflicted, as if your heart isn't raw like freshly tattooed skin or a cracked egg on a sizzling skillet. You walk briskly and with determination. One would never guess you dropped your heart into a sticker burr bush. Look at you, cracking a joke, going down a slide with your three-year-old, sighing despite your cynicism, searching while exhausted, and dancing barefoot with blisters on your feet. Look at you, crying over cheesecake, eating oranges like they don't remind you of your sister or like you don't miss your mother. Look at you, pawning for breaths for bread. Look at you, breaking hearts like a pro, not because you're evil, but because you're you, an elephant on Tuesdays. On the journey to yourself, you block out sunlight, trample fields of flowers, and destroy the homes of small creatures, such as the nature of large animals as yourself. Look at you, writing your books and painting pictures that people hang on their living room walls.
Look at you, making your grandmothers proud without having to learn how to make tortillas from scratch. Look at you with a baby under each arm. Look at you, stepping on traumas and overcoming odds. Look at you, surviving. That heart you broke back in 1999 still smiles when she remembers your horrible Robert De Niro impersonation. You never look fat in your coworkers' wet dreams, and you look beautiful even when you growl. Your resilient heart must be threaded with gold string. I'm sure it looks powerful and royal between your smoke-damaged lungs. Oh, how I wish you'd leave those damn cigarettes. If you could see yourself through my eyes, you would blush. Lock yourself in a room just to be alone with a vision. If you could see yourself through my eyes, you'd write poems about your lips and collect your falling eyelashes in a box. You'd store your tears in empty spaghetti jars to use as salt on the rim of your margarita glass. You are special and miraculous. You used to be a single cell in your mother's ovaries when she was still in your grandmother's belly. Your unique fingerprints could inspire a new artistic style, a Chicano Renaissance that would put all other eras of enlightenment to shame. Your muscles are beautiful under your brown skin, and your organs are working well enough for you to listen to music and to a poet's words. I'm not saying you're perfect, not by a long shot. You can be pretty venomous, and sometimes you don't use your rattle to warn of attacks. You've been vengeful, you find it hard to forgive, and you have more vices than you would admit to. You don't love as much as you should, and you like to gossip. I've also been told you think you're a descendant of Netzahualcoyotl and that you're addicted to intense emotions. I've heard you've skipped work in order to flirt with 14th century poets who whisper prayers to your ears. I've heard you're addicted to parasympathetic nervous system responses and that you wish you could bottle up oxytocin, dopamine, and adrenaline. I've heard you personify Celso Piña's accordion and that you think you sound just like Chavela Vargas when you're singing in the shower. But then again, we shouldn't believe everything we hear. Despite all things you don't like to say aloud and all that you feel guilty about, you're loved and you make dreams come true. Despite the fact that you are destroying the world and that sometimes even your mother loses hope that someday you'll change, I still marvel at your walk and at your DNA. I still marvel at your carbon footprint, and I think nothing matters while being of utmost importance. And of course, I still think that love can fix you, and if love can fix you, well then surely love can fix me. Sincerely, the old back lady who talks to butterflies. For Words on a Wire, this is Nancy Lechuga.
We'd like to thank our guest, Mary Shebas, for joining us today on Words on a Wire and for reading that lovely poem. And Nancy, thank you for loving humanity. Speaking on behalf of all humans, I appreciate it. And we love you back. I just want you to know that.
Thank you, Daniel. It was a pleasure.
And thank you, Nancy, for co-hosting this show. We always like to have you. Join us next week for another edition of Words on a Wire. I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Nancy Lechuga.
And don't forget, the next book you read
might save your life.
I'm up on the tight wire. One side's ice and one is fire.